Welcome to the History of the Papacy podcast, a podcast about the history of the popes of Rome and Christian church. Prepare yourself to step behind the ropes and leave the official tour of the story of the popes and Christianity. I'm your host, Steve Guerra, and I thank you for joining me on this journey. You can find show notes, how to contact me, sign up for our mailing list, and how to support the history of the papacy by going to our website, a2zhistorypage.com. Two great ways to support the history of the papacy are leaving your ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. And another really great way to support the history of the papacy is by going and joining us on Patreon at patreon.com/historyofthepapacy. Your support on Patreon goes a long, long way to help keep the history of the papacy sustainable for a long time in the future. There are four tiers of support on Patreon: Antioch, Alexandria, Constantinople, and Rome. Each of these tiers represents one of the traditional patriarchates of early Christianity. There are many great benefits to you for supporting the show on Patreon. You will receive early and advertisement-free content, bonus episodes, monthly book drawings, and most importantly, you will be included on the History of the Papacy Diptychs. In traditional Christianity, the diptychs are the lists of bishops commemorated in order of their precedence. The sooner you sign up on Patreon, the higher you'll be on the lists of the History of the Papacy patrons. Now let us commemorate the Patreon patrons on the History of the Papacy Diptychs. We have Roberto, Joran, William B., Brian, Jeffrey, Christina, John, Sarah, William H., Augustus, Keanu, and Judy at the Alexandria level, Dapo, Paul, Justin, Lana, John, and Steve, all of whom are magnificent at the Constantinople level, and reaching that ultimate power and prestige, that of the See of Rome, we have Peter the Great, Leonard the Great, Alex the Great, and Amma the Great. With that, I hope you enjoy this next piece of the mosaic of the history of the popes of Rome and Christian church. I think that what you've said really has clarified a lot for me right off the bat. And so I guess I was in the mindset that I knew that the Mazzinis and the Jacobins, that side, they were definitely the radicals. But I guess in my mind, I was playing it out more that the monarchists in the House of Savoy was the reactionary crowd. But are they more of a moderating and modernizing influence, say, than just pure reactionary?
Their party was not completely a reactionary, I wouldn't say, because the monarchists still, they wanted a liberal monarchy, which is a very different thing from an absolute monarchy. So the absolute monarchy, where you have no parliament, you have no constitution, you have no civil rights, that's a completely different thing from a liberaldom, which is what the monarchist party wanted. They wanted a system like Britain has today. So, which is, you know, maybe not as democratic, but, you know, as democratic as Britain was at the time. So in that sense, they were not reactionary or conservatives. They were on the innovation thing for two main reasons: liberal and unification. Also, unification is a form of canceling the existing, because unlike the Federalists, they wanted a unified country under one king and one government, not a federal or a federation, which is a more loose form of government. They wanted a strong monarchy, similar also to, again, what Britain has today. Britain now has devolved some powers to Scotland and Wales, but it's one of the more centralized country in the world still. So they wanted a centralized country, so more modern in their way of thinking. Then modern, you know, depends on the point of view, obviously. So they wanted a centralized country and they wanted a liberal monarchy. So I wouldn't call them reactionary.
Amongst these three groups, then, would you say that there really was an idea that the peninsula needed to be unified in some way, that was pretty much the general feeling going on, at least amongst, maybe not, maybe let's avoid the people at a moment, for the moment, because I mean, in the grand scope of things, sometimes the people really don't matter, are there, but amongst the leaders and the intelligentsia.
It's hard to say, but it's, yeah, so that's, all these three groups wanted unification in different ways and forms, but they wanted unification. As I said, there were also the ones that didn't want you. But I will say they became increasingly a minority. The people that didn't want unifications were mostly foreign power, mostly Austria. Austria really didn't want Italian unification because that would mean creating a new country, potentially rival, losing. By the way, for Austria, the Kingdom of Lombardy and Venice was very important. It was 1/6 of their population, but was fully 1/3 of their revenues. So this was a rich piece of their empire. They did not want to part with it. It was really important for their... They what they perceived as dominion of Europe. They, you know, you have to understand that Austria also played a lot on the chess game in Germany. And in Germany, their big rival was Prussia, but you had a lot of small states in between. And they needed that power coming from having this big empire, including this dominion in Italy, in order to be stronger also in Germany and extend their influence in Germany. So that is really the power that all these separate groups want to defeat. And it's not easy to defeat, as we shall see very soon.
Steve here again. We are a member of the Parthenon Podcast Network, featuring great shows like Josh Cohen's Eyewitness History and many other great shows. Go to Parthenon Podcast to learn more. And now, here is a quick word from our sponsors. The idea of a unified Italian people, who are they thinking were Italians? Because into Switzerland, there's people who speak at least a dialect of Italian and would maybe identify as Italian. All along the Adriatic coast and the Balkans, islands like Corsica, Sicily, Sardinia, even into places like Greece, there was people who were thinking of themselves or spoke something akin to Italian. Who were the... these leaders, these thought leaders, saying these are the Italians who we want to unify?
So, and this is unfortunately a very problematic topic because, and it's a very problematic topic because from this question stems the two wars. So not specific to Italy per se, but in general for Europe. Because when Europeans started saying, okay, we are nations, but these nations, bar few exceptions, did not have fixed borders. Everybody interpreted the border as they saw fit. So Italians, of course, they saw every piece where you have Italian speakers as part of Italy. They saw Istria, the peninsula in the northeast, you know, northeastern Adriatic as part of Italy, and today this is part of Croatia. They saw pieces of Dalmatia, again, part of Croatia as part of Italy. The islands, you said, you know, the islands in the Ionian Sea, they were under Venice for centuries. One of the greatest Italian poets is from there, Ugo Foscolo. And, you know, also a lot of people thought about those as Italian. But, you know, the population in none of these places was 100% Italian speaker. They were all mixed up because they were not separated in nations. You had a king or an emperor that did not really care if you were Italian or German or Austrian or whatever, because these things, this concept didn't even exist. So people just lived next to each other. And in some cases, they still do, but the borders, the ethnic borders have hardened. But they were not so hard at the time. So you had areas that had 50% Italians, 40% Italian, 30% Italians and maybe some nationalists, they will think about them as Italian, but you know, not everybody there spoke Italian. So so this whole concept of building the nation can have grave consequences, and it will have grave consequences, because at the end, fascism will do some damage in these borderlands where the Italian identity mixed with others. So so what I'm trying to say is we shouldn't look at this map and make, you know, strong lines dividing countries. That was not the case at the time. And a lot, the world wars were exactly that, because, you know, after Italian unification, there were still areas that Italy claimed as Italy, but they didn't get it. And Italy went to war against Austria in 1915 to get them. And hundreds of thousands, a million people died on both sides of that. So, you know, a million people is a lot of people, is more than any American that has died in any war that has been fought by America. So just to give you an idea of the scale of the destruction, and this is only one front of, even not the most important one, of the First World War. So I'm talking about only one world war, one front, and not the most important one.
Yeah, I think that really contextualizes how big this goes back to.
Yeah, yes, I like to contextualize, because, you know, I think it's important when you throw numbers or dates that, you know, they get grounded in the reality so that people can measure them and can get a glimpse of what they actually mean. So otherwise, they're meaningless. And also, I would like to say, for example, also the ground thing, you know, 1815 to 1848, this is the period before the American Civil War. So America was already a country, but it had not gone through the Civil War yet. So again, if you want to, if you know American history, you can contextualize it, thinking about that.
I mean, that's interesting too. Maybe let's talk about a couple of the major events that get us from 1815 to 1848 during this time period, especially one of the main characters who will come up during this part that's especially important for the history of the papacy, because he's one of the probably the most important popes of all time.
Yes, Pius the Ninth is a very complex figure. His election is basically was seen by the New Guelphs, the Confederalists, as a sign of the time, as the time were ripe for their plan, because this was not a reactionary pope. This was not a conservative pope. This was a pope that had some liberal feelings, liberal leanings, and was also a patriot. So people knew that he was, you know, he was an Italian. Many popes that were, you know, born in Italy, they did not think about themselves as Italians. They were, you know, the popes of the universal church. That's something different from being an Italian pope. So, because again, that concept is fairly recent. This was really a pope that thought about himself as Italian. And that created some expectations from him that he would lead the way in the Italian unification. He would do something very important when the time was ripe. And I think this was, you know, It was doomed from the beginning, because it's not the role of the papacy to build a nation state against other nations. The role of the church is universal, and the papacy would have never survived that. I think that was a dream, but you know, that doesn't mean that people cannot dream, right? So the Pope, when he was elected, he enacted reforms, liberalizing the political system. in the Papal States, signaling his willingness to reform. So again, that brought high hopes. All that, though, we have to see all that in the backdrop of an enormous conflagration, which is about to explode and which is about to completely, get out of control. So, you know, the Pope will not be able to control it. And at a certain time, paradoxically, he will become a symbol of the reaction. So he had an extremely long pontificate. And at the end of his pontificate, everywhere in the world perceived him as an extremely conservative. Just to give you an idea, the person, this is a really interesting journey that, you know, starts here and ends there. And in a way, I don't think he moved that much. I think that the world moved. So he was, let's say, liberal when he started, and then he was a conservative when he, you know, at the end of his papacy.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I wonder how realistic was the position of people like Pius, maybe Pius, but people who thought that the Papal States could actually exist in a unified Italy and that the Pope could possibly somehow be the secular leader of a united Italy. Was that complete naivete, or was that something that people honestly entertained?
People honestly entertained, because the Pope was a secular leader and had been for a very long time, and, you know, a not insignificant secular leader. You know, it's, the Papal States may look small on a map and small in general, but they were not that small. It was a sizable country ruled by the Pope already. So you think, like, you have already 20% of Italy. You just have to make it 100%, you know? And the other idea is, if it's a confederation, it needs like a head of state. So this is another concept that is different between the American and European system. So head of state and head of government, they are not the same person. Head of state is the king, for example, or the president of the republic in a parliamentary system, is not the head of government. In America, you have a system where the head of government and head of state are the same person. But that's not the case for nearly, I would say, all European countries. So what they were thinking is to have a head of state as the Pope, that of course will leave the government to a prime minister, elected probably, you know, or anyway, answering to a parliament. So they weren't, in that sense, it's not complete naivete. You know, you are just substituting the British system, a king with a Pope. I still think it's naive in that sense, because the Pope anyway is not a king. The king anyway has a role only within his dominion, whereas the Pope has to be the Pope of the entire Christian Church, at least the Catholic Church. And, you know, and that role is too universal. You know, imagine if, and this is where you know, the rubber will hit the road. You know, what if you have to declare war on a country that is a very Catholic country, like Austria, the bastion of Catholicism in Europe, the bastion of Catholicism in Germany, where you have Prussia that is Protestant, and what is the counterweight to Prussia? It's Austria. So if you don't want Germany to become Protestant from the point of view of the Catholics, you want a strong Austria. So how on earth the Pope can declare war on Austria and defeat Austria on the battlefield? Because that's, it will have to come to that, because Austria is not relinquishing one third of its income without a fight.
Steve here again with a quick word from our sponsors.
Now we're starting to get into, so this is the conflict that we have here, is that we have these different groups who really have such different ideas of, they all have the general idea of a unified Italy, but they all have such different ideologies of outcomes. So there's going to almost naturally become conflict out of there. What is the conflict, and where do the battles and the war come out in this fight?
Yes. So this, we have to talk about 1848. I've alluded it several times. I think this is where we should go. You agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is 1848? Some old Italians, when I was little, still said that if a year was really bad and a confusion and something incredibly happened that year, so probably today, this year, last year maybe, they will say, è successo un 48. Like, so it happened at 48. Like it's an incredible mess. So what happened was that there was a revolution first starting in Palermo, where they asked for freedom of speech and, they basically rebelled against the Neapolitan government. Again, this conflict between Sicily and Naples has a long story, right? We've seen from the 14th century. So it started there, but this was only the beginning. Then, and this is the very beginning of 48. And then we have some of the Italian states start granting spontaneously constitutions, like the Grand Duchy of Tuscany, and the Pope also allows a parliament and allows new, more liberal laws. So the Kingdom of Piedmont Sardinia declares a constitution called the Statuto Albertino, the Albertine Statute, which, by the way, will be the Constitution of Italy, will become the Constitution of Italy, of course, when it gets unified, and will remain the Constitution of Italy until after the Second World War. So this is the 1848. So, but then the biggest thing was in February, when Paris erupted against the monarchy. There was a sort of a proto-liberal monarchy in France. They had already a revolution in 1830, which I didn't cover because it's too much history. But sure thing, you know, they had a kind of a more liberal king, but that was not enough for the French. They wanted a republic. So they fought against the armies of the king, and at the end, they declared the Second French Republic, 1848. As soon as they declared the Second French Republic, it was like, imagine, these are the people that went through the French Revolution, and they know what happens when France declares a republic. So the news spreads like wildfire from every single country. You can even measure by the distance from Paris, you know, how long it takes for the news to travel from Paris. Every single country in Europe erupts at the same time. You have all the Germans go against the Prussian king. They demand the constitution from Prussia. Remember, one of the three autocratic powers, and they get it. And then the unthinkable happened in March. Vienna revolts against the Austrian, and Metternich, the arbiter of Europe for 40 years, is sent to pension. And, you know, the Austrian emperor has to let Austrians start having some freedoms. This is like huge news. This means the entire order built after 1815 is about to collapse. When this news arrives in Italy, which had started a bit this process, something new happens again. And it's only a few days after Vienna, the news arrives in Milan and then also in Venice. And both cities, the two capitals of Austrian Italy, they revolt against the government, and the biggest battle is the one in Milan. It's called the 5 days of Milan. Basically, the entire city fights the army. The Austrian army is a significant piece of the Austrian army that was headquartered in Milan led by the Marshal Radetzky. I don't know if people watch the New Year's concert in Vienna. At New Year you have this big concert in Vienna every year. I like classical music, so I watch it every year. And it always ends with the Radetzky March. So probably somebody will recognize the music if I do it. Is parabam 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 pam pam parabam 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 pam 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 pam. Anyways, that music was written in honor of Radetzky, and we'll see soon why. So Radetzky, though, gets defeated in Milan, and he has to withdraw to Verona, the real big stronghold of the Austrian in Italy. It makes sense. It's a heavily defended fortress, and it's next to the the Austrian part of the empire. At this point, basically, everybody looks at the Pope and says, okay, you can lead this. And he even forms a small army formed by a bit. It's more like his people form an army, and then he gives his blessing to the army to be sent for the war against Austria. And at the same time, the king of Piedmont Sardinia position himself, and he receives basically a message from Milan saying the leader of the Milanese was a Republican, a Mazzinian. And he told them, there's only one word that will silence the word republic, and it's gratitude. So if you come to our help, we will not declare a republic, but you have to come to our help and declare war on Austria. And the king of Piedmont Sardinia, King Albert, he declares war on Austria. So at this point, things are accelerating. And we're talking about only weeks apart from the first match. And we are in only March. So this whole thing started and went very quickly. So at this point, we have this expectation. And people are looking, is it going to be the king of Piedmont Sardinia or the Pope leading this thing, whatever this thing is? And the Pope kind of, at this last minute, he realized that he cannot really declare war on Austria. He sends word to an army that he sent to the north saying, you cannot attack Austria. You can defend the Papal States, but you are not, I repeat, not allowed to invade Austria. At which point the army invades Austria. And they said, we don't care. We don't care what you're saying. So we will just do whatever we want. And this is when the situation spiraled out of control of the hands of Pius. He realized he could not lead a war effort against Austria. He had cold feet, and the people then decided, okay, if there has to be a leader, then it has to be the king of Piedmont Sardinia. At this point, though, something funny happens, that Radetzky is a great general, and he, instead of fighting the Piedmont Sardinia, he goes against the army of the Pope, defeats them, and makes them surrender. Then he swings towards west, defeats also the army of Piedmont Sardinia. It was a well-trained, a good army, but it was not as strong as the Austrian army. And at this point, we are towards the end of 48, there is an armistice between Piedmont. It's not an armistice, it's more like they decide not to stop fighting for a few months, but there's nobody has yet said, we give up. But basically, the Austrians recover Milan, which was the big prize. During the winter of 1848-1849, then the situation just spirals out of control in Rome. The Pope tries to nominate prime ministers that are liberal-leaning, but that does not placate the public opinion. And at a certain point, his prime minister is killed in the streets. And the Pope realizes he's not safe anymore in Rome, and he escapes. He escapes to Gaeta. It's a small town, the first town in the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. I haven't mentioned the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies in this story because they did play a part, because the King of Naples, he sent a small army towards the north, which probably the Patriots wanted them also to join in the effort to kick the Austrian out. But then he also got called them back and sent instead to quell the rebellion in Sicily, which he did. So at this time, the Pope escapes to the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. And this is what breaks really the relationship between the Pope and the liberal forces. Because at this point, in Rome, they declare the Roman Republic. So Mazzini actually comes to Rome. Garibaldi is there too, and they declare the Republic of the Roman Republic. And as I was saying, already declaring a constitution was a big thing. Declaring a republic is really like saying, you know, we really want something truly innovative. But it's a Roman republic, so it's a republic only of the papal states. But they declare the republic, and there's even elections. Anyways, so I don't want to go too much further, but I just want to give you an idea of what happened in this year, in very confusing years. If you want, then we can go to the end game, because the end game is that all this fails. So the incredible thing of the revolution 1848, and I have only narrated, you know, a little piece of it related to Italy, and really in few words, you can say a lot more about it. But overall, over the months, basically the forces of revolution starts receding as the force of reaction reorganize in Prussia, in Austria, the Hungarians are defeated, the Germans, the German attempt to create a nation is defeated as well. And then when the Piedmont-Sardinia restarts the war, is defeated by the Austrians, by Marshal Radetzky, which kind of spells the end for the Roman Republic as well. The Austrian army sends basically an expedition to reconquer, you know, to defeat the republics in the south. And even the Republican France has fallen under the rule of Napoleon III, which will eventually become emperor. Napoleon III, and he will send basically an army in the region of Rome to restore the Pope to his throne. So at the end, in 1849, the last bastion is Venice. Venice had declared also a republic. They have been a republic most of their history. That's the last city that holds out in the middle of the lagoon, but after they are dying of starvation, they surrender. And that's the end of the revolution of 1848, 1849. It gets to the middle of 1849, but by that time, then it's over. And basically, the restoration has won. All the states, all the rulers go back to where they were before the revolution. So you may ask the question, what was all that for, right?
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask.
Yeah, no, and, you know, and let me know if I go too much in details, but at the end, all this was like an enormous trial for all Europe. This is called the Spring of the People, when all these people, they fought on the barricades to get a nation and get freedom also at the same time. They failed, but the seeds they planted, they will grow in a sort of way, although much less idealistic and much more realpolitik in the following decade. It will be the iron fist of Bismarck to make Germany, not the revolutions of the people. And it will be at the end the armies of Piedmont-Sardinia to make Italy, although with the help of, you know, of the idealists as well, in the 1860s. And so here is when we talk about the other two dates. You know, 1849 is when this revolution ends. Then you have only 10 years of status quo, which tells you everything. 10 years is nothing. It means that really the status quo was untenable. Even though it was rebuilt as a status quo, it was completely untenable. And it was bound to fail in a way or another, because this revolution of 1848 had demonstrated that Europe wanted something different. And they will eventually get something different. So that's the story of the revolution of 1848-49.